BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Shahida Bari, and welcome to this episode of the Arts and Ideas podcast, in which we'll hear an essay from one of the 2019 New Generation Thinkers. They are early career academics who work with BBC Radio 3 and the Arts and Humanities Research Council on a scheme that turns their research into radio. I was one of the first 10 people chosen for the scheme nearly 10 years ago. In this year's essays, you'll hear topics ranging from clean energy, crime and punishment, and archaeological views of the earth, to moving large tracts of it to build dams in Pakistan, Renaissance art, racism in techno music, and rethinking facial disfigurement. Christina Faraday lectures in the history of art at the University of Cambridge, and her piece has the intriguing title Tudor Virtual Reality.
A couple of years ago, I became obsessed with dinosaurs. It started with an innocent trip to the cinema to see Jurassic World 2 and culminated with a ringside seat for Walking with Dinosaurs, the Arena Spectacular at Wembley. Along the way, I had visited the animatronic T-Rex at the Natural History Museum in London. I weighed myself on the What Dinosaur Are You machine at York Museum, and I tried out a virtual reality headset to meet a brontosaurus. At first, I had thought of all of this as a mental break from my other obsession, Tudor art. After all, what could be more different from Holbein than a hypsilophodon? But as I sat in Wembley Arena, eye to eye with an animatronic stegosaurus, I realised that my obsession with dinosaurs wasn't just because dinosaurs are really cool. In fact, I was seeking out the most vivid and spectacular ways of recreating them in an attempt to grasp their reality. I found them so hard to imagine, I was seeking ever more elaborate ways of making these long-extinct creatures feel real to me in the present moment. This problem of how to vividly represent something absent, historical or imaginary, so that it seems real or really present, is thousands of years old. It was an especially pressing issue for the orators of the ancient world in Greece and Rome. They needed to capture their audience's attention and hold it for long periods, and they didn't have robotic monsters, PowerPoint, or other whizzy pictorial aids to help them do it. The skill of rhetoric or eloquence was necessary in the political arena and in the courtroom, but also in the theatre and for everyday entertainment. So they developed techniques to conjure vivid images in the listener's imagination. They called the ability to create vivid mental images energeia, and they considered it the most powerful technique for winning over a jury or an audience. Perhaps one of the most enthusiastic advocates of this technique was the ancient Roman orator Quintilian. He published his guide to public speaking at the end of the 1st century AD. It explains how a speaker could bring their descriptions to life and gives the example of the invasion of a city. Simply stating "the city was stormed" might explain the disaster adequately enough, he writes, but it does not touch the emotions. Instead, he says, we should try to develop a much more detailed, vivid account of everything that happens. Then he says, there will come into view flames racing through houses and temples, the crash of falling roofs, the single sound made up of many cries, the blind flight of some, others clinging to their dear ones in a last embrace, shrieks of children and women, the old men whom an unkind fate has allowed to live to see this day. The audience will see the pillage of property, secular and sacred, the frenzied activity of plunderers carrying off their booty and going back for more, the prisoners driven in chains before their captors, the mother who tries to keep her child with her, and the victors fighting one another wherever the spoils are richer. Quintilian wants us to get down to details, make our descriptions specific, and appeal to a variety of senses. He wants our audience to see the flames spreading before them, hear the collapse of roofs and the cries of victims, even smell the smoke or imagine the last embraces of the terrified inhabitants. In Quintilian's description, events seem to unfold before us in real time, their detail, specificity, and multi-sensory qualities making his speech powerfully immediate and moving. These techniques were enlarged on, translated, and transmitted over millennia, through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. In Tudor England, a revival of classical learning and increased interest in education blossomed under the influence of humanists such as Erasmus, Thomas More, and John Colet. New schools were founded, curricula were rewritten, and the art of rhetoric took pride of place in the new educational landscape. Generations of students were taught the principles of powerful communication. Not just nobility, but the children of middling, professional, and even poorer families were taught how to use the technique of multisensory energeia. By the 16th century, the principles which Quintilian and others had outlined had found scientific backing in current understandings of psychology and biology. The Tudors had inherited their ultimately Aristotelian model of psychology from the Middle Ages. On this view, thought itself was a complex system of mental images. Sense impressions received through the eyes, ears, and other organs were transmitted to a part of the brain called the sensus communis, or common sense. There they were recombined to create vivid mental pictures of things sensed. These images were processed in other parts of the brain, such as the imagination, which dissected and recombined them with other mental images. Then the estimation judged and acted upon the information it received. Finally, these images were stored in the memory, which was located at the back of the head. This was obvious, said the theorists, because people who receive an injury to the back of the head often have trouble remembering things. In the Tudor model, everything that came in through the senses, whether it was seen, heard, or tasted, became a mental image. Even words were processed in this way. As a result, any speech that created a powerful mental image had a more direct effect on the mind than less vivid descriptions. These ideas informed writers of all kinds of texts in Tudor England, but they also seem to have infiltrated visual art. For the Tudors, imagery, whether in paint, woodcut, tapestry, or needlework, was a powerful form of communication. It told stories, represented mathematical and scientific knowledge, and recorded people for posterity. In all of these situations, the viewer needed really to grasp what was in front of them and be persuaded of its moral, historical, or scientific truth. And what better way to convince them than by the time-honoured technique of energeia, the vivid evocation of a subject or event, so that it almost seems to be happening in front of you. This is important because it goes against the grain of what has traditionally been said about Tudor art. According to the old view, Reformation arguments about the dangers of idolatry had made people nervous of having any images at all, especially powerful images that represented events in a vivid and immediate way. As a consequence, Tudor art's apparent lack of naturalism and single-point perspective has been interpreted as a deliberate effort to avoid some of the dangers inherent in artistic realism. But if we look at what vividness really meant for people at the time, we find that in fact, these images did correspond to their ideas of powerful and immediate communication. However, just like my quest for Jurassic realism, the Tudors recognised that though images have a vivid head start when compared with words, visual representation on its own isn't enough to produce a lively impression of reality. As a dinosaur junkie, my trip to the cinema was only the start of a search for bigger and ever more immersive thrills, driven by the same principles of vividness established by Quintilian nearly two millennia previously. Similarly, Tudor artists needed to produce images which provided specific, immersive, and highly detailed information to make their messages powerful and exciting. One place we find this kind of vivid communication is in narrative imagery. Tudor interiors were often highly decorated, with large-scale wall paintings representing biblical or mythological stories. One popular subject was the Judgment of Solomon, a story from the Old Testament in which two women seek King Solomon's judgment in their dispute over which of them is the true mother of a baby. Solomon reveals their true identities by suggesting that the child be cut in half so they might share it. The pretender approves of this plan, while the real mother begs for the child to be given away rather than injured. This story was popular with Tudor audiences for a variety of reasons. On the one hand, it was a story with a moral. A wise patriarch makes a good judgment and settles a domestic dispute. In this sense, it was a reminder of the duty and authority of the male householder, who was expected to rule wisely within his household for the good of his family members. But for Protestant viewers, the story had a deeper, spiritual level. It was a reminder of the Christian themes of sacrifice and salvation, a reminder of God's mercy in saving the faithful from eternal death. In domestic settings, the story would have represented the inhabitants' moral and spiritual duties to one another and to God. It provided a fitting backdrop to household prayer and other daily activities. The Judgment of Solomon is the subject of an impressive Elizabethan wall painting in a house called The Forge, situated in the village of Much Haddam in Hertfordshire. In the 16th century, this house was owned by the Noose family, who also had their coat of arms painted alongside the royal arms in the same room. The choice of the Judgment of Solomon shows off the family's spiritual and domestic interests, advertising their wisdom and piety to their visitors. We can identify a few different techniques which make the painting's message about the Noose family particularly powerful and memorable. Just as we read words on a page in English, we might be tempted to read this wall painting from left to right. If we do that, we find that the image isn't just a representation of a single moment in the story, but seems to make the narrative unfold before us while we're watching. On the far left, we see Solomon enthroned on an X-frame chair, traditionally associated with Roman emperors, the highest kind of earthly authority. We see his regal arm outstretched, his finger pointing. He is giving his instruction that the child should be cut in half. This pointing finger directs the viewer's gaze onwards, leading us to the next stage in the narrative. After the instruction comes the king's attendant, ready to carry out his orders. He raises his sword, dangling the baby by its leg in his other hand. Then, as we move to the right again, we see the child's real mother fall to her knees, her hands together, begging the king to reconsider his judgment and give the baby away rather than let it die. Behind her, the other woman stands with her arms folded, seemingly content to let the baby be killed, revealing her status as the imposter. This painting doesn't just give us a snapshot moment standing for the whole story. As we read the painting from left to right, the events actually seem to unfold before us. This is precisely the kind of sequential description recommended by rhetoricians like Quintilian. By revealing the sequence of the narrative, the viewer feels almost as if the events have taken place in their presence. One other detail gives this painting its powerful, vivid status. Although the story is taken from the Old Testament, the characters aren't dressed in antique costume. In fact, they are wearing the ruffs, slashed doublets, and stripy hose of fashionable Tudor courtiers. Solomon himself wears the high standing collar, ruff, and feathered cap of a Tudor monarch, not an ancient patriarch. His facial features and curly red-gold hair even resemble those of the then-reigning Queen Elizabeth I. All of this helped to give the scene contemporary relevance, a bit like when we go to see Shakespeare in modern dress. It fits perfectly with advice from the rhetoricians to make it seem as though your description is unfolding in the present moment before your audience's eyes. In the 21st century, we're surrounded by photography, CGI, and other breathtakingly realistic imagery. It can be easy to assume that when it came to visual art, the Tudors were essentially dinosaurs, with an artificial and unrealistic way of seeing that was doomed to extinction within a few decades of a new century. But by identifying the techniques which corresponded to their ideas of what vividness should look like, we can begin to recapture some of the power and excitement that these images would have had for contemporaries. And then we'll be seeing almost like a Tudor person saw.